Good morning, everyone. We're going to call Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee meeting to order. We do have the minutes ready from last meeting. Do I have a motion on the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Nash moves the minutes from March 19th. Any discussion of those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. All right, first on the list today, House File 1665. Representative Dean, welcome back to the committee. And I'll go ahead and move House File 1665 to HHS Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for having me back again this morning. I have for you House File 1665 that will be heading to the Finance Committee. It's another small, non-controversial technical bill. This will... In fact, it will affect another program, Minnesota Care. Minnesota, as many folks may not know, has a program called the Basic Health Plan, which is one of only one in the country. It was envisioned by the framers of the ACA to be what was called a public option when it was presented nationally, and Minnesota was the only state to really pick up on that. The BHP covers folks who make between 133% of federal poverty guidelines and 200%. And what that really means for a single adult is around $16,000 a year to $23,400. And for a family of four, that's around $33,500 to $47,700. And a family of six up to $63,940. So that kind of gives you a ballpark of the income brackets that we're talking about. The monthly premiums on this are extremely low, which makes it very easy for folks to use, which is about $15 per person to $50 per person. And so that is what makes it very affordable for people, but what we have had traditionally in Minnesota Care, most of the people who were in legacy Minnesota Care have been transitioned to Medicaid. Those are the folks under 133% of the federal poverty guideline. So this is that group in the window in this BHP band that we are looking at transitioning to private health care insurance. So what that will do is that will help our private health care insurance market by putting about 60,000 more families into that market, and it will strengthen the market, and it will also be a benefit to hospitals and providers by providing higher rates, because if you go from, let's say, a BHP program to Blue Cross Blue Shield, for example, the reimbursement rates will be higher. So there's some benefits to the hospitals and the providers in that manner. Traditionally, the Minnesota Care product that we had before the ACA had a hospital cap of $10,000. That has been removed under the ACA, which has really exploded the cost of this program. And if you look at in your spreadsheets from HHS, you'll see that for these 60,000 plus families, we're looking at almost $1.2 billion being spent. Now, we were told from the feds that the cost of this was going to be picked up by the federal government, but in fact, we are being under subsidized by the federal government. And that's really blown a hole in our budget. So the state is having to make up that difference, and we really can't afford to do that. That is what has drained the health care access account, taking it from $600 million surplus. We were projected going into the year to have a deficit, and that's really where that has come from, shifting money out of that account to make up for the difference in what the federal government is supposed to pay us from what they are actually paying us. What this would do is would allow us to have a stable private health insurance market for this group of folks moving forward. The public policy debate, this really more for health policy and for our broader legislature, is really where do you draw that line between folks who need help and probably can't choose their own plan to folks, where do you draw the line to saying people can choose which plan they want? That's really the benefit of this, is that people can get help with their premiums and deductibles through support from the government, and at the same time be able to choose what's right for their family to make it affordable. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, what I'd like to do is to have Randy Chun come forward and just kind of walk through how this works from a government ops standpoint. I think it'd be interesting for members to understand what Minnesotans actually do when they go online to try to buy this stuff. And if Representative Sanders is applying online for his family, and I'm applying online for my family, and Mr. Chun is applying online for his family, how we actually see different prices. When we, even if we have the same similar circumstances, we're going to see different prices because things happen behind the scenes that's, I don't think very many members know about that. So if I could have Mr. Chun just kind of walk through a little bit about that, because I think for this committee you'd find it interesting and perhaps instructive for other decisions you might be making.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair and members, Randy Chun with the Health Research Department. I guess maybe one way to go about describing this would be to explain the differences in sort of the application process and the, I guess, the benefits and cost sharing that the individual would be would either receive or be subject to. In both cases, both under current law and under Representative Dean's proposal with Minnesota Care 2, the individual would apply for Minnesota Care 2 through MinSure, the state's insurance exchange. And that is the same general pathway to which they apply for the current Minnesota Care or Basic Health program. And while all of the details are not specified in Representative Dean's bill, probably the most likely way this would work would be that things would be as sort of automatic or transparent for the enrollee as possible. For example, the Minnesota Care 2 plan picks up the federal cost-sharing reductions, which would raise the actuarial value of a silver plan from 70% to either 87% or 94%, depending upon a person's income. Right now, under the state exchange, there is a cost-sharing reduction that raises the actual value of a silver plan from 70% to 73%. These are for persons with incomes between 200 and 250% of the poverty guidelines. The way that is implemented now is that the cost-sharing reductions kind of appear automatically on the screen when a person applies for or is trying to choose a health plan, through the exchange website. And the higher actuarial value is usually in the form of either a reduced annual out-of-pocket limit or a reduced deductible. So in most likely that is how the MinSure board would implement Representative Dean's proposal for Minnesota Care 2. The higher actuarial values would appear automatically on the screen in the form of a reduced deductible or in the form of a reduced out-of-pocket limit. Another difference would be that instead of getting the current Minnesota Care benefit set, the individual would get the standard qualified health plan benefit set that's provided through the exchange. plans that the health plans themselves would receive subsidy, would receive payments for the federal government for reducing the cost sharing. In other words, for providing a higher actuarial value plan. That most likely would happen in the same way as it currently happens for raising the actuarial value from 70% to 73%. The plans would give the federal government a projection of their estimated costs, and the federal government would reimburse the plans with a settle up at the year end. Representative Dean's bill would provide an additional premium subsidy for enrollee premiums, and that would probably be paid directly to the health plan, so the enrollee would not be responsible for paying that extra amount and then being reimbursed. And if there are any questions, I could answer those.
Thank you, Mr. Chun. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And just for non-insurancy people, actuarial value means that if you pay out $100 and it's a 94% actuarial value, that the person is responsible for $6 and the plan's responsible for 94. So the higher that number, the richer the richer the plan. And so that one of the things that we wanted to try to address was that lower income people and that wouldn't purchase plans with very high deductibles that they probably wouldn't be able to afford. So the hospitals were saying, hey, if we have people with really high deductibles, that's going to wash up on our shores. So we need to buy up those actuarial values so that from the platinum, gold, silver, the higher up you go on the metal level, the less risk there is for the providers and for the hospitals. So what I envisioned, what I asked for, was actually kind of a silver-plated gold plan so that we could actually get people up to a higher metal level to reduce the risk for the providers. And that's what we're trying to do. And I think what Mr. Chun is describing is what a person would see if they were going online and purchasing this is that would happen kind of behind the scenes. And that if we subsidize that, we actually buy them up a metal level without them seeing that on the front. So when you see the 94% actuarial value, that's what's brought up. And I had a handout, and I don't know if that got passed around or not, but it actually just kind of goes through if you're currently on the BHP, what you would be paying as a single adult and then a family of four. You would see increased premiums. You could see this from a $16 to $45. From a family of four, $64 to $92 at 138. And then down below at the upper portion, this would be the max, would go from $50 to $124 and $200 to $255. So that's kind of it's going to cost people more. Governor Dayton proposed in his initial proposal that we would have increased premiums. People in Minnesota Care do currently pay premiums, although it's a very small percentage of the overall cost of the program. So you'd see modest increases with that as well. One of the things we wanted to do is just test it out with the plans just to see, is this workable? What would we see in terms of this? And this would be very comparable to what folks in all of the other 49 states would be doing if they were in our boat. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, be happy to answer any questions, or if we have other testifiers who are on the list, we can deal with those as well.
Thank you, Representative Dean. I don't have any other testifiers listed. Was there anyone else wishing to testify? Seeing none. Okay. Come on down, and if you would, please introduce yourself for the record.
Hello, Representative, members of the committee, Chair, Dean. Representative Dean, my name is Sarah Greenfield. I am the healthcare program manager, with Take Action Minnesota. I would like to oppose this proposal. MinnesotaCare has provided reliable, comprehensive, and affordable health coverage to Minnesota families for the past 20 years. Minnesota is proudly the first state to successfully transition our longstanding history of leadership in this area into the format and language of the ACA, which is, as Representative Dean mentioned, the BHP. New York and other states are in hot pursuit because the standard package of the ACA is not enough support for this population. In January, 88,000 Minnesotans, almost all adults, were enrolled in MinnesotaCare. If we look at who is on MinnesotaCare, they're hardworking Minnesota adults making anywhere from $8 to $12 an hour and earning roughly $15,500 to $23,400 per year for single adults. They have precious little disposable income to spend on premiums, deductibles, and copays for health care. They reflect our changing economy and shifts to more part-time work, low-wage service sector workers whose jobs provide no benefits. They live disproportionately in greater Minnesota. The top 25 counties for MinnesotaCare per capita enrollment, looking at enrollment for those aged 20 to 64, roughly the population eligible for this, are located in greater Minnesota. Also, according to testimony by DHS earlier this year, individuals are sicker on MinnesotaCare and thus need support for their health care services. This bill requires MinnesotaCare families to choose among more costly options on MinSure with dramatic variation in out-of-pocket costs. MinnesotaCare families seeking to purchase a silver-level plan on MinSure would face a significantly higher premium. Looking at the current plans, consider the example of a 40-year-old single adult earning 190% of the federal poverty level. The premium range for silver plan coverage on MinSure for this individual after the federal tax credit is $107 to $198 in the Twin Cities, $108 to $177 in Rochester, and $106 to $161 in Willmar. Even with any, you know, small additional reductions in that premium, they face additional cost sharing that they would not face on MinnesotaCare. And that individual on MinnesotaCare would currently pay $50 or less a month for his or her MinnesotaCare premium. Unfortunately, this difference in premiums alone, not to mention the additional cost sharing, means that many folks, even if an adjusted silver-plated plan is available, are unfortunately not going to find that affordable for their budgets and will be looking at bronze coverage that really does leave them not adequately covered for their needs. We appreciate the intent of the bill to create a premium assistance program, but we question its technical feasibility. It would require MinSure to design and implement a complex new system to determine eligibility and transfer state funds to health plans. This adds a new layer of complexity to MinSure at a time when they should continue to improve the core functionality. If this premium assistance program proves unworkable and silver plans quickly become unaffordable, the only choice that many MinnesotaCare individuals would have would be a bronze plan. Exposing low-income Minnesotans to such high and variable health care costs would be extremely harmful and would mark a dramatic reversal in how Minnesota has long provided access to health coverage. MinnesotaCare has worked for 20 years in this state. It is our tradition of leadership, and we would encourage you to oppose this bill and instead support the MinnesotaCare program that is currently serving our state so successfully and is at particularly in a time of surplus in both the general budget and the health care access fund that changing direction for these families does not make sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grinfield, for your testimony. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Chair and members. One of the things that I think was probably not included in that was the tax subsidy that actually is a very complicated thing, and that's why I wanted Mr. Chun to kind of come down and walk through what that actually means for people when they sign up, that actually happens behind the scenes, and I don't think that those numbers reflect that tax help that can get built right into the plan as you're going through the process. And the handout that we have shows basically what that means from an individual and also a family of four. And there's no two ways about it. There's an additional premium involved. But I think when you look at the differences in the examples that were laid out, that is a modest increase, but it is also one that is seen by people all across the state of Minnesota who have been seeing these increases, and particularly middle-class Minnesota premiums have gone up in the last few years in particular greater Minnesota small group plans are really gone through the roof. So what we're seeing here is just kind of a model of what people might see within that, and I don't think Ms. Greenfield's examples included the tax subsidies that would be involved that these numbers do reflect, but these numbers also don't reflect the additional dollars that we would be able to put in to buy that up, which is what we're anticipating.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Moving to member questions and discussion, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I'd like to call a roll call.
Roll call is requested.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, maybe it's not enough coffee and the late night and early morning, but I guess I'm a little confused here. The bill we had last night would repeal MnSure, put us in a federal exchange. The bill you're presenting this morning would create this, eliminate Minnesota Care and create a new program that would be administered through MnSure. I guess the question I have is, how do the two bills work together? Are you envisioning them both passing and becoming law, or is this just these just different options that you're putting out there? Because if the bill we passed last night out of here becomes law, there's no MnSure for this program to be administered through.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, what this envisions is private health insurance being purchased by Minnesotans with assistance from the government. That's the model of the ACA. Currently, in Minnesota, we have not enough people in that pool to sustain the current program. This would add 60,000 families to that group that would allow that private market to be more functional. We also have to redeploy the forces or the dollars that we would have spent in the bureaucracy of MnSure to try to get to help to people so that they can sign up for health insurance that they can depend on for a long time. That's what I'm trying to do, is to look out not just to the end of this year and next year, but to do what families and small businesses do, which is to look out several years to say, what is it actually going to be around here for my family or my small business in 4, 5, 6 years? We're going to have small group insurance policies, and we're very likely going to have assistance for lower income people to do that. We need one plan to do that, not two or three or four that don't work. We need one plan that does work, and that's kind of where I'm heading. So thanks for the question.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if you answered the question, because I guess my reading of the bill, and maybe I'm reading it wrong, but we're keeping MnSure to be the portal for these people to access this new Minnesota Care 2 program, which is going to cost more, and we all know insurance costs. It's the premium may be one, but it's whatever the level of care is, your co-pays when you go to the doctor may be hidden there, as we found out with the Medicare Part D, that when you, depending which one you picked, you could have, you know, that seniors found out that maybe some of their stuff wasn't covered, co-pays might have been higher. So they might have bought a cheap plan on the front side and on the back end and end up costing more money. I just don't envision how this works with your bill you had yesterday, that we're trying to get people to go through MnSure to access this program, but then on the other bill we're getting rid of MnSure. So I guess I'm just confused, Tom. And then the other thing I see in this is that you talked about is now we're going to be relying on the state creating subsidy programs, and I don't know if it was in this committee or another that I mentioned that many years ago, when Governor Carlson was there, they set up a program for daycare support. For the goal was to get people who were on welfare off of welfare, and they daycare support for these parents to be able to go to school to finish their degrees so they could get into the workforce and get better paying jobs and get off of welfare, but they didn't fund that at a high enough level, and halfway through the second quarter of the school year, program ran out of money, and all these people that applied and were accepted in school and going to school had to drop out of school and because they didn't have daycare anymore. And I just envision this as another train wreck that might be coming down the road. So I'm not going to be supporting your bill.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, what we want in Minnesota, we have mandated through the ACA that everyone purchase health care insurance. And for people who don't work for a company with or the government like we do, it's really hard to access private health insurance. So we have an exchange, federal exchange program that has been set up and mandated for people to access health care through. We currently have a system that doesn't work. I think we would all want a system that does work long-term for the state of Minnesota, and we want to do that by trying to get enough people within that exchange to actually make it work and also to get a plan that does. So 34 other states are not having the issues that we are currently having with MNsure and the glitches and the finger-pointing and the problems and the backlogs that we talked about last night. We want to help the people that are caught in the middle. We want to redeploy those dollars and people that are currently doing that. And we're also going to need a bigger, we're going to need more people in the program for it to work and make sense. Also, I would just want to point out that we are being reimbursed for the BHP significantly under cost. And the state of Minnesota did not anticipate that we were going to have to make up that difference in our budgeting. And that's why the Healthcare Access Fund has a big, gigantic hole in it, because we are having to make up the difference between those two. So we would be able to offer choice for people and also be able to fix our long-term problem with the Healthcare Access Fund, realizing that we have a 2% provider tax that is going to sunset in December of 2019.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, I've heard you mention, as well as the testifier to this bill, mention the Healthcare Access Fund. And what is the current adequacy of that asset base? Some 2 years ago, I think there was a much larger base in it than there is now, and I'm just wondering if you could expound in terms of the cash flow in and out of that fund over the last couple of years and where we stand today.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, the first committee hearing that we had going into a subject area in Health and Human Services Finance was on the Healthcare Access Fund, and we went through MMB gave a presentation on the history and future of the Healthcare Access Fund. We had projected large and growing balances within the Healthcare Access Fund in the last biennium. And in fact, within the bill that we passed sunsetting the 2% sick tax in Minnesota, if enough of a balance accumulated in the Healthcare Access Fund, we would actually ratchet down the 2% provider tax by 0.5% at a time. Had the money not been shifted out of the Healthcare Access Fund and into the general fund, that actually would have gone from 2% to 1.5%. But because of the transfers, largely because of this very program and other uses in the general fund, that did not occur, and in fact the balance has gone down, was slated to go below zero into the next biennium, and now with the improved economic forecast, I believe we are up to 100. It was minus 60 in the last projection. I think after the February forecast, I believe it's plus 100.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other member questions or discussion? Seeing none, Representative Dean will give you the last comments.
I appreciate so much committee time. Sorry to take up so much of your time on the last couple of days before deadline. I really appreciate the questions, appreciate the support.
Thank you, Representative Dean. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1665 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Roll call being requested. The roll will be taken.
Chair Sanders.
Aye.
Vice Chair Pugh.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Nope.
Representative Albright.
Aye.
Representative Fenton.
Aye.
Representative Halverson is excused. Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Mullery.
Aye.
No.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll is excused. Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Runbeck.
Aye.
Representative Seltzer.
No.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
No.
There being 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda, House File 745, Representative Howe. Representative Howe, welcome to the committee. I'll go ahead and move House File 745 to be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a bill that went to the House floor to the General Registry last year. And this bill does 3 things from what the current law does. One, it gives the veteran a choice. It gives the right now, current law dictates that this deals with veterans' preference and veterans' hearings when the veteran gets notice of intent to discharge or to fire. And current law says that you've got to, if the city or the county has a civil service board or a county personnel board, that the veteran must use those boards or commissions. The change in this bill from that current statute would allow the veteran a choice either to go to the veteran's preference board, or actually go to the civil service board of the county personnel board, or go to the 3-member panel that's currently outlined in the current statute. The second thing it does is currently teachers that are veterans aren't allowed to use this process. This would allow teachers the same right and availability to use this veterans hearing process. The third thing it does is it provides that the employer who starts this proceeding pay for the cost of the veteran's hearing. And if the veteran prevails, the veteran's attorney's fees, reasonable attorney fees. So, Mr. Chair and committee, that is the bill. And if it would, I've got a testifier here, Chris Rohner.
Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record, let us know who you represent, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Rohner. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Howe, and most importantly, veterans in attendance today, thank you for the opportunity to address this committee on this important issue. My name is Chris Rohner. I've been a police officer in Minnesota since January 11th, 1993. And I live in Andover. My intent here is not to disparage my employer, but to tell you my story. I know my time before you is short, so I'll attempt to consolidate the last 3 years of my life into a couple of minutes. As a young boy, I knew I wanted to be a soldier. I joined the Army at age 17 and served on active duty once I graduated from high school. After I left active duty, I began a career in law enforcement, but I always felt I had more to give to the military and more to accomplish. So in the year 2000, I joined the Minnesota National Guard. And in December of 2000, I deployed to Saudi Arabia with my National Guard unit for the first time. As everyone here knows, September 11th, 2001 changed everything. And 4 more mobilizations and deployments would follow that one. I spent nearly 6 of the last 14 years mobilized and deployed overseas, nearly 2.5 of those years in combat as an infantryman. I returned to Minnesota for my last year-long deployment on May 1st, 2012. On May 3rd, I dropped my then 2-year-old daughter off at daycare and stopped by my police department to say hello. I found out that my access card had been turned off and there was a note waiting for me in the dispatch office telling me I had been placed on administrative leave while an outside agency conducted an investigation into a situation that occurred in 2010 while I was assigned as the detective sergeant for my police department. I called my police chief to discuss the situation. In the course of that conversation, he told me he thought this would all be wrapped up at the end of next week. Now, mind you, that was the beginning of May 2012. The end of May 2012, the outside agency finished its investigation and determined that there was no wrongdoing. Their investigation was reviewed by two separate prosecuting agencies who concurred with their findings. The administration didn't like the findings of these three independent agencies and decided they were going to do their own investigation. At the end of June 2012, I learned in my administration that my administrative leave was in an unpaid status in violation of both the law and our collective bargaining agreement, and I had to get my union involved. After working unsuccessfully with the union on resolving the pay issue, I was finally told by them, my union, that I should contact a military lawyer. I was truly alone. Thank God I found a law firm that really cares about veterans. By January 2013, the back pay issue was unresolved, and I was forced to file a civil lawsuit against the city. 2 days after they were served, the city delivered an intent to terminate notice to me at my house, and they sent it to me via another veteran. I requested and was given a Laudermill hearing, and the city subsequently reaffirmed my termination, again sending that same veteran to deliver the notice. I chose to appeal the termination in front of a three-member panel, as would be laid out in this bill. A hearing was held over a series of 11 days in June, July, and August of 2013. The city took 8.5 days to present its case, and I took 2.5 days to refute it. In October of 2013, the panel unanimously reversed the termination decision, and I was ultimately returned to work in December of 2013. In October of 2013, I had a meeting with the chief of police and the operations captain to discuss moving forward after this investigation and hearing. I was told I was a valuable member of the department and I had a lot to offer. I left that meeting feeling like we'd be able to move forward as a department. The next day there was a knock on my door, and when I answered it, I was served with a lawsuit by the city for $66,525.14. The cost of my selected arbitrator and half the cost of the neutral arbitrator. The case was heard in district court in December of 2013, and the city's case was dismissed in January of 2014. The city filed for reconsideration, and the district court refused that request. I can tell you that's a surreal experience to have to take vacation days from work to defend yourself in court from a lawsuit your city filed against you, or to get your paycheck on Friday and look at it and realize it's not going to cover a quarter of the cost of your monthly legal fees. In March of 2014, the city filed an appeal with the State Court of Appeals, and a case was heard in front of that court in October of 2014. The Court of Appeals upheld the dismissal of the city's suit in a November 2014 decision. And it's my understanding that the two arbitrators were finally paid in December of 2014 and January of this year, just 2 months ago. And that's the Reader's Digest version of why I'm here before you today. To date, I spent nearly $41,000 on attorney's fees defending myself and fighting the city's lawsuit. And that's at a very discounted veterans rate, thanks to the law firm I chose. And I still have the possibility of nearly $67,000 bill hanging over my head. I watched the testimony on Representative Howell's bill in front of the Veterans Affairs Committee last year, and it was clear that every member of that committee understood the spirit of the law was that the employer needs to pay the cost of the panel. But the law as it currently stands leaves enough ambiguity that an employer can leverage their vast financial assets against the lone veterans. Last year there was testimony that this change and the law wasn't needed because it doesn't affect thousands or tens of thousands of veterans. This issue, thankfully, does not affect thousands or tens of thousands of veterans because most employers understand and comply with the law. But it does affect some veterans, and those are the ones that need this help. This bill comes too late to help me, What's done is done. But if that's the good that comes out of my situation, then I can live with that. This bill would not prevent employers from firing cops who are or any public employees that are veterans for incompetency or misconduct. I can tell you that nobody hates bad cops more than good cops. And certainly doesn't take any rights away from veterans. It would ensure that a veteran's case can be heard in front of an unbiased panel that's not hand-picked by the same employers trying to fire them. And it'll assure of veterans not have to choose between exercising their constitutionally protected rights and paying their mortgage or sending their children to college. I urge you to support H.R. 745, and I thank you for the opportunity to tell my story.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr.
Come back to you later.
Oh, that's fine. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to let you know, since I served on the Hopkins City Council when this incident took place, I'm going to recuse myself from the vote.
Thank you, Representative Joaquim. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Howell, for bringing this. And I want to thank my constituent for your testimony, and primarily I want to thank you for your service to this state and this country and being willing to sacrifice so much for us. And I just wanted to say, if I can be of assistance, please let me know. And again, I appreciate your service, and thank you for this bill. I'm going to wholeheartedly support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Howell. I remember this bill from last year. We passed this out. And if I remember it, we passed it, and it passed on our floor of the House, or what, did it die on the floor? It didn't get voted on. And I guess that's the first question. The second question, is this bill different from last year? And what if it is, what is different about it from last year's bill?
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what's different about this bill, and last year it got to the General Registry, but it didn't move in the Senate, so it never came to the floor. The things that are different in this bill from last year are two items. One, we include teachers, because we don't believe that just because the employer you choose in the public entity, your rights change. I do believe that if you work for a public entity, your rights should be across the board, no matter if you work for a school district or if you work for the city of St. Cloud or where you work. The other thing that's different is it doesn't, the last bill did not include attorney's fees. This bill includes the attorney fees only if the veteran prevails. So in that sense, what it does is if someone, it should prevent the bad actors from continuing on to this case, because they're not going to be able to get their attorney's fees, and they're going to have to pay their own attorney fees. Only if they prevail and they have a good case will their reasonable attorney fees be paid. And those are the two differences between the bill that went to the General Registry last year and this current version.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So hearing that, what he just said, it'd be similar to the legislation we heard, the SLAPP legislation, to try and prevent from retribution. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Generally, we do the reasonable attorney's fees when there's something wrong by the other side. And I'm wondering, first of all, if it was a really bad case by the city's part, why wouldn't there be under either the rule or under the statute reasonable attorneys allowed? And then second of all, is there some place between those and automatic attorney's fees where there's some type of, you might say, at least a misjudgment by the city or something like that in pursuing the case? In other words, I believe reading this, it's an automatic attorney's fees, no matter, isn't it? If you prevail. If the veterans prevail, isn't it automatic whether or not the court feels that there was a justifiable defense by the city?
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mullery, I think the difference here is at any time the city can fix this. The city or the employer starts this process and carries this process. So at any time they can realize their mistake and decide that this isn't the process they want to go through. Fact is, and it's my belief, they could probably avoid this process altogether by deciding, we're either going to dismiss you and you're going to have a bad record, you're going to get fired from a job, or you can just resign and go away. So I think there's a lot of different alternatives for the city or the government employer to go through before they get to this stage. But I believe that unless there's some cost to the employer when they get to this stage of the game, there's no reason for them not to carry it through because they've got the staff, they've got the dollars on their side, and they can run it to the end. And to say it doesn't happen very often, I did a four-year court battle. I know what this is like. I've been to appellate court with my employer. So to say this doesn't happen very often, if it happens to one of us, it's too many times. And I tell you what, it cost me a ton of money because I didn't have anybody paying my attorney fees but me. So if there's a way to get this to where you actually have a fair shake and you put it on a level playing field for the employer or the veteran, we need to make that happen. And this gets it done.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howell, yeah, I definitely don't want it so that the city can, I know what you're talking about, can the city has powers. I guess if it's a 51-49, balancing, is the city really evil in pursuing it? That I'm wondering if there's a place in between automatic attorney's fees and the present situation where you just don't get them, no matter how wrongful the city case is. In other words, if Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, I guess what, think about it, if you pursued and very legitimately pursued a lawsuit and you were right and it happens that the other side wins the case for some reason, maybe the jury found 51-49, should you get everything then, or that's my question in attorney's fees.
Representative Howe.
Well, I don't think they're getting everything. Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, apparently you've never gone through one of these processes, because I tell you what, the scrutiny that you get from your fellow employees and other members is not many times favorable. These actions put a great deal of stress on the veterans. You're looking at their livelihood, something that they do for a living, and they're being challenged. And if there's another, if it's a 49-51 on the edge thing, don't you think that they can do something besides fire them to get to this stage of the game? I think there's a ton of alternatives, either through union action, because most employees that work for a governmental agency belong to a union. And if there's another option, I would believe that they can probably go through another option. When you take it to this level and the stress that you put a veteran through, I believe, yes, they should get their attorney's fees for the pain and agony that they got to go through to go to this stage and this level of thing. So if they're a bad actor and deserve to get discharged, to get fired, it'll never get to this stage because they're gambling that they're going to win this thing and get their attorney fees paid. If it's a 50-50 deal, I don't think they're flipping the coin to go this direction and have $40,000-$50,000 worth of attorney fees to get to this level of game. I don't take those gambles, do you?
I haven't been
Representative
in that situation. No further questions.
Thank you. Any further member questions or discussion? Seeing none, Representative Howell will give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this has been a very passionate thing for me the last couple of years to deal with, and I appreciate your hearing this bill on the final day, and I thank you for your support.
Thank you, Representative Howell. Thank you to your testifier. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 745 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Next on the agenda is House File 437, Representative Scott.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing House File 437. There are a couple of amendments, Mr. Chair, if we could take care of those first to get the bill in the shape that I'd like.
Okay. I see, looks like two amendments. I have a DE2 and a DE3.
Right.
Which are you offering?
I believe I need to offer the DE2 first because I believe the DE3 is amended to the DE2. No? Oh, okay. I believe somebody else offered one of these.
Okay.
Let me see here. I would like to move the DE3. I'm sorry.
Representative Scott moves the DE3. Any member discussion? Well, it's a delete all, so maybe we will have you walk through it first. But this will. Here, let's do this. Let's take the DE3 to put the bill in the shape the author wishes, and then we'll have you proceed from there. All in favor of the DE3, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Thank you.
The DE3 prevails. Representative Scott, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill sets up a surrogacy commission, and the DE3 matches with the Senate language that was a compromise language that was worked out between the authors and stakeholders, including Outfront Minnesota. And so it sets up a commission that consists of 15 members. 12 of those are from the House and the Senate, bipartisan from both the majority and minority parties, and also includes represented from the Commissioner of the Department of Health of Human Services and then the Department of Health, and also a family court referee appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. This commission would run from the first meeting would be required to be by July 1st, and then the commission would end in December of 2015. There's language in here that says that if there's a conflict of interest in some way, that a witness in a public meeting would have to disclose that, as well as any members of the commission. On page 2.1 through 2.22 is a list of things, among the things that the commission would study. This is not an exclusive list. There would be other things too, but this is just kind of a starting point for the commission to be studying. And then a report would be due by December 15th. And if there were topics that the commission failed to agree upon, there would be both a minority and a majority report. And the staffing would come from the Legislative Coordinating Commission. As I said, the current delete all amendment is a result of concerns that several groups have had with the original bill language. In civil law, invited other legislators, groups, and interested parties to contact me about any language that concerned them in this bill. So this significant language change in the current engrossment are a result of multiple discussions that the supporters of this bill have had with these groups over the past month. I am committed to having a good commission that the legislature can trust, which is why I introduced this new language. House File 437, as I said, would set up this surrogacy commission to examine the many considerations associated with surrogacy arrangements in Minnesota. Although surrogacy arrangements are currently happening in limited numbers in Minnesota, the legislature has not declared surrogacy contracts legal, meaning that a judge has no duty to enforce a surrogacy contract. Over the past decade, bills have been introduced that would legalize surrogacy contracts and create the structure for full-blown surrogacy business. These bills have failed to move forward due to disagreements about the social and legal implications of surrogacy and how to protect all parties involved in surrogacy arrangements, including intended parents, the surrogate mother, and the child. As you can see from some of the written testimony and materials, and by the way, I think there was a letter written by an OBGYN that got in the packet with Representative Dean's information, but it applies both to his subject and to mine. And so these materials approach surrogacy from a variety of perspectives. While I recognize that many surrogacy arrangements do not end poorly, some arrangements do end in heartbreak or trauma. As a legislature, we have responsibility to protect those who may be in vulnerable situations. Opinions on how surrogacy ought to be legislated vary, from more regulation to bans on for-profit commercial arrangements. Despite the different opinions, there is consensus that more needs to be known about surrogacy. I would refer you to the document from Minnesotans for Surrogacy Awareness that provides some perspectives on the needs for a study commission. Along with the lead Senate author, Senator Alice Johnson, I believe that it is time for our colleagues to create a bipartisan commission of legislators and public officials to receive testimony and engage in a fact-finding process for surrogacy arrangements. The commission will report its findings to the whole legislature, allowing us to be in a better position to consider proposed legislation. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would shoot it back to you. I don't know if there's anyone else that's here to testify on behalf of the bill.
Great. Thank you, Representative Scott. I do have a list of some folks that wish to testify. We'll just start in the order that I have on the list. Callie Kolkind. I apologize if I botched your last name, but if you would just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
So you actually were pretty close. It's Callie Kolkind, K-O-L-K-I-N-D, so you did a good job. According to the supporters of this bill, I am an uneducated, low-income subclass breeder. Although the language in this bill has changed, it doesn't take away the fact it was created upon false pretenses and opinions. I was born and raised in Minnesota. I'm a mother to four of my own children, and I'm also a gestational carrier. I had the privilege of carrying twins for an amazing couple. Although she was born without a uterus, they were able to use her eggs and his sperm to make their perfect embryos. I was 38 weeks pregnant when I delivered two healthy baby boys. To become a gestational carrier, my partner and I had to pass criminal and financial background checks, have medical records approved by an IVF doctor, have my own personal OBGYN approval, pass several tests administered by licensed mental health professionals related to psych evaluations, have multiple interviews with agency social workers, and pass medical screenings at an IVF clinic. This bill makes extremely strong presumptions while lacking factual information. I am a gestational carrier. I was very educated and researched the choices I was making before I started this journey, throughout it, and after the delivery of the babies. I am not economically disadvantaged. I have a full-time job, and so does my husband. I am not psychologically damaged. I was not and never have been coerced, intimidated, or forced into making any decisions I was not comfortable with. I am fully capable of reading, comprehending, and making decisions. Throughout my journey, I had 24-hour access to a social worker, journey coordinator, and also legal representation independent from my intended parents. I continue to have contact with the agency that I chose. There is no need for this bill. When used correctly, the process is nothing short of amazing to be involved with. As with everything in life, if you follow the process, doing what is suggested, it is efficient and nothing short of amazing. My greatest gift in life has been the birth of my own four children. I began this journey with the motivation of wanting to give that experience to someone who could have never otherwise had the option. But I have gained so much more. Ultimately, I was given the greatest gift of all. I was entrusted with the twins for 8 months and able to give them back to their parents healthy and happy. I hope you remember me when you think of surrogacy in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Randall Korfman.
Well, good morning. My name is Randall Korfman. I'm a reproductive endocrinologist. Just a bit about my background to give you a hint of why I think I'm qualified to speak on this morning. I was born and raised on a farm in Kansas, but trained at a number of different places. I got a PhD in biochemistry at Kansas State University, my medical schooling at University of Kansas, then did a residency in University of Kansas, and then did a fellowship in reproductive endocrinology at Yale. Mayo Clinic hired me to come set their in vitro fertilization program back in 1989 when I came to Minnesota with a full head of hair and without the need for reading glasses. I practiced in the Twin Cities then, moving our program to the Twin Cities so I could care for people that live in a number of rural areas of Minnesota, North Dakota, Montana, and Wisconsin. I take care of patients who have a variety of needs, and once in a while a patient will come in with needs that require us to have to use someone to help carry a pregnancy for them. I was brought up that you treat every patient as if they're your daughter, your wife, or your mother, and if you do that, you'll never go wrong, and I've tried to hold that steady as I practice medicine over these last 25, 26 years. I want to clarify some terminology that I think is confusing for my patients and I think for you. Surrogacy is when you would take sperm and inseminate them into a woman, and she would then conceive with her eggs using her uterus, and she would deliver the baby. She would be, in most states, considered the birth mother. So in most states, including Minnesota, the birth mother is a mother of the child. In a surrogate situation, she would then have the claim that she not only carried the pregnancy for 40 weeks, but she also had half of the genetic makeup of that child. So the concern is that she could change her mind and renege on the contract, and then that couple who were going to be the intended recipients of the child would not be able to carry through with that. That is not something that we do in Minnesota. And I know of no infertility clinic in the state that does that. We do gestational carrier, which is what Callie described, which is where we would take the sperm and eggs from a couple, perform in vitro fertilization, and transfer into a woman like Kelly to carry the pregnancy for them. So when that baby was born, while Kelly would be the mother of the child, she would not be the genetic parent of the child, and that contract, we feel, is held then in court. And we do that frequently in Minnesota. In 2013, there were 31 gestational carrier. In the year before that, there was 30. And that's a pretty steady number. I say that is not increasing. So I wanted to mention that to you because my concern when I saw this bill was that there is no need for this. We are actively following the guidelines of the Federal Drug Administration because this is considered as tissue, human tissue. And all of our clinics are eligible and go through routine testing by the FDA and site visits to make sure that we're following their guidelines. Furthermore, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine has guidelines that we follow to the letter because we do not want a bad outcome for our patients. One of the things that has hit me as I've gotten older is that not only now do I have to look at this as my mother or my daughter, my wife, or my mom, I have to think about now I have a granddaughter who's 4 months old. And what I don't want to have is something happen if she would happen to lose her ability to carry a child, or my daughter, who's not had a child yet. I want her to have the same access to high-quality caring care that our gestational carriers have here. They go through intense testing, as Callie mentioned. They go through a social worker visit, through psychological testing, infectious disease testing, and we make really sure that she knows what she's getting into and that she has her own legal representation that is separate from the intended parents. I think it is a great system, and I think that when I saw that, I really feel that I wish that you would not let this bill pass.
Thank you, Mr. Korfman. Next on the list is Ms. Sarah Greenfield. Once, twice. All right. How about Julie Berman? Welcome to the committee. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Julie Berman, and I am here representing Resolve, the National Infertility Association. I am a Minnesota resident, and I serve on the board of directors of Resolve, a national nonprofit whose mission is to improve the lives of women and men living with infertility. Infertility is a common disease that affects 1 in 8 families. Resolve works on legislation and issues in all 50 states and with the U.S. Congress, and we oppose this bill. We are opposed to creating a commission because, as you heard, medical guidelines, legal roles, and mental health best practices are already in place to dictate gestational carrier agreements. The medical guidelines set forth by the American Society of Reproductive Medicine are based on the most recent recommendations from the CDC, the FDA, and the American Association of Tissue Banks. Women who choose to be gestational carriers for another couple, the intended parents, are treated under these medical guidelines to ensure that they are well informed about their choice. In addition, they go through rigorous psychological, medical, and legal evaluation, as do the intended parents. A few of those guidelines are worth stating here to give you a feel for the depth to which they govern the process. Gestational carriers may be used when there's a true medical condition or a biologic inability to conceive. Each party requires separate legal counsel. All participants are screened by mental health professionals. Gestational carriers should have previously experienced a full-term pregnancy, as Callie mentioned, like she did, before embarking on this process so they understand the true nature of carrying a pregnancy to term. And all parties are counseled in the process and its potential risks and screened for medical concerns and issues. In addition, the outcome of every IVF cycle, so that means every gestational carrier cycle, is reported to the CDC by federal law. Every clinic, IVF clinic, has to abide by FDA guidelines, and this is a very regulated field of medicine. We are opposed to creating a commission because this bill uses inaccurate terms and the bill drafters did not consult experts in the field and have left out key facts such as the two types of surrogacy that Dr. Korfman explained.
Uh,
We are also opposed to creating a commission because the intent behind this bill is not transparent. Two of the supporters who are not from Minnesota travel from state to state supporting anti-family legislation. They are not here to speak for Minnesotans. Their goal is simple: outlaw gestational carrier surrogacy in the U.S. So this bill is not about patient safety or helping women who choose to be gestational carriers or thinking about the resulting children. It's about setting up a process so that a bill to outlaw these family-building options can be introduced next year or the year after. We've seen these same bill supporters in other states do just that. Thankfully, their efforts have been unsuccessful. We are also opposed to the commission because we have seen that state law can be very helpful in offering further regulation so the best practices are codified into state law, and traditional surrogacy arrangements are discouraged. We support legislation that does that. A study is not necessary. So we are opposed to this bill. We do not see the need or reason for any type of commission, task force, or committee to study it, study surrogacy. What we do need is the Minnesota legislature to work with us to introduce and pass meaningful legislation that provides guidance to the courts regarding parentage, protects all families and all parties involved, and most especially the resulting children. In the last 20 years, more than two dozen laws have been passed at the state level in this area, and every single one has been affirmative. We are here to work with you and look forward to doing just that in preparation for next year. But for today, let's discard with the notion that a surrogacy commission is in the best interest of Minnesotans. We urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Berman. Having no one else on the list, is there anyone else that wishes to offer brief testimony on this House file? Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. My name is Chris Stinson. I'm the policy director for Outfront Minnesota. I think Monica was on the list, and so she texts her regrets at not being able to be here. I'm stepping in her place. So thanks for having me. Like I said, I'm with Outfront Minnesota. Our mission is to create a state where lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are free to be who they are, love who they love, and live without fear of violence, harassment, or discrimination. And the reason that we're speaking to this bill is because many same-sex couples choose surrogacy as the way to build a family. As an aspiring parent myself, I haven't talked to Paul about it, but this is a route that we may choose to take in the future. And so I want to say thank you to Representative Scott for your willingness to work with us on the language. I just saw the amendment when I walked in a few minutes ago, so I can't speak to whether or not Outfront is able to support the current draft of the language. But I can tell you that we're very pleased with the changes that I was able to identify, especially the inclusion of health and legal experts as voting members of the commission. And so I think that that's an important improvement. There are still some places where I think that there's cause for concern, and I imagine, given how willing to work with us Representative Scott has been so far, that we might be able to find some common ground. I just like looking to line 2.9 and 2.10, there's a reference to business practices of the fertility industry. People who are reproductive endocrinologists find that term to be kind of pejorative. And so I think that we would want to work with the author to talk about medical and legal best practices of fertility clinics, attorneys, agencies, and reproductive endocrinologists to make that kind of a language change there. There's also a reference on 215 to 2 and 216, potential conflicts with current statute, without any reference to the possibility of a statutory remedy to those conflicts. I think that it's entirely possible that the conflicts in the law there could be resolved by changing the statute in favor of supporting surrogacy. Then there's on 218, there's a reference to a surrogate mother, which is a term that I don't know is defined anywhere in practice. I think that the preferred term is gestational carrier. And so the same thing on 222, gestational parent, I think, is a term that doesn't have meaning. And gestational carrier, I think, would be the more appropriate term. But like I said, I just looked at this, so there may be other things, but I really appreciate I appreciate the author's willingness to work with us on getting the language right. And then Yeah, so I guess I would just kind of conclude by saying that this delete everything is a step in the right direction. I think that there's some additional work that needs to be done, but I think that we also, the Outfront's official position is that the current situation where surrogacy is not covered by statute at all and is entirely governed by contract is probably not the best situation, and so we should move forward. I know that Representative Lesch introduced a bill yesterday that we would support, but if this body believes that more research is needed before you're able to take action, I think that we're getting close to something that I think we can all agree on.
So. Thank you, Mr. Stinson.
Sorry if there was a time limit I wasn't aware of.
Thank you. We have one other testifier on the list, Mr. Jason Atkins. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jason Atkins. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, which is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. We're glad to hear from a number of people today to talk about this issue. I think the testimony, though, shows that there is a need for greater study of this complex question of surrogacy. And it's not simply those who are opposed to surrogacy arrangements who think this is an important bit of study, but there's a diverse array of perspectives across the ideological spectrum, both locally, nationally, and globally, who are concerned about this issue. Don't just take the Catholic Church's word for it. I know that this has been characterized as simply someone imposing their religious views on someone else, but that's hardly the case. After considered judgment, we have deep concerns about surrogacy, particularly when money changes hands. And you've heard from three parties opposing this legislation this morning who've all benefited financially from surrogacy arrangements. Indeed, Ms. Berman's organization, Resolve, the board of that organization is made up of members of pharmaceutical companies who definitely have something to say in support of or in opposition to this. The question is why anyone would be opposed to more study, considering it's so complex, considering many states ban the practice of commercial surrogacy. The nation of Canada, religious country, a secular country, has just decided to ban commercial surrogacy as recently as 2007. Many nations of Europe, places that were formerly centers of reproductive trafficking, such as in Southeast Asia, have tightened their regulations with regard to surrogacy. Indeed, we recognize that ultimately a bipartisan commission of legislators engaged in an important fact-finding mission may not ultimately produce recommendations that are something that we are consistent with our own particular ethical views, and we are fine with that. What a commission will do is we'll take some time to responsibly study this issue in more detail before legislation, such as it's been proposed in the last few sessions, and as Chris said from out front, that was proposed just recently by Representative Lesch, simply ensures that these contracts are considered enforceable contracts by judges and that they are not unconscionable. We shouldn't be surprised that an industry, in many cases, probably doing what they think are best practices and are right, is saying, don't regulate us. We're doing fine. But in every industry, there are always bad actors, and that's why we have regulation. So, indeed, as you've seen from the testimony submitted to you in written form, I have a big packet here of a big study done by leading global feminist leaders and academics just recently in December at The Hague. Huge report, huge study in just 4 days about the many, many concerns and dimensions of this issue. The responsible thing for Minnesota to do before we jump headlong and headfirst into the surrogacy business is to take time and study this in more detail. One could hardly conceive of a more no-brainer legislation. This legislation proposes no policy. The definition, whether we say traditional surrogates or gestational surrogates in the actual language, is of no consequences. Both types take place, and indeed you've had written testimony from a traditional surrogate, not just a gestational one. Surrogacy contracts are operating in an extra-legal environment. We agree with Outfront Minnesota that ultimately some sort of regulation needs to take place, and a commission is in the best position to study this issue in depth, engage in that important, non-biased, non-partisan fact-finding process, and then report to the legislature with its full studies. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Moving into member questions and discussion, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott, I know you've worked hard. I hear there's still some heartache with this, but I understand you approached us last night that you've been working hard on this, and it sounds like some of the groups are saying you're coming together. So I guess I hope that as this goes forward that you continue to work with the all the parties
if not get the peace in the valley, at least not outright warfare in the valley.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson. Yes, I've been taking notes as the testifiers have come up, and I will continue to work with others in this endeavor.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. That's
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard from the advocates and discussed it with them, and I certainly agree that we don't want what they tell me happens in India with a commercial surrogacy. But I'm from hearing now some of the testimony today, I'm thinking that is never going to happen in America. And we know that the cases, as the one woman said, it can be amazing and wonderful. We've heard about the oversight, both from the FDA, the federal and legal parameters, and how the clinics are very careful, and how this woman went through, her family went through multiple tests. I consider though maybe if we need to put some of that in law, that's the regulations. I'm concerned that the members of this commission, if I have the DE3, I believe, it's basically the legislature. I don't see any experts there. Maybe that needs to be addressed, but I just need to say, as a person who's had four pregnancies and a set of twins, no woman is going to do this lightly or repeatedly. Pregnancy is a huge impact on the woman, physically, hormonally, emotionally. It's even considered one of the most dangerous things that a woman can go through. So it's not something that women are not little factory systems of some sort. This is a very serious an undertaking by any woman, and I don't see how it could possibly be seen as something that we have to protect ignorant people from knowing that it might harm their health or something. So my concern is that this commission is a lightweight in without expertise on it, just us talking, you might say, and perhaps there's a way to put in statute some of the things that are being the regulations that the clinic obstetrician spoke about regarding oversight by the FDA and the legal parameters. But I don't really see a problem, and if it's been 31 cases of amazing and wonderful for a steady basis here for a number of years, I'm not sure that we have a problem that we need to urgently take action on. So I'm just concerned that we might be a little ahead of the need and reacting more to fear and misunderstandings of how it's actually operating.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for those comments, Representative Lane. One of the things that I, as you know from working on this child custody issue together, I have a great deal of concern for the family. And although the surrogacy arrangements worked out for the testifier that we had earlier, nothing was said about what happens if those arrangements go sideways. There's nothing in law right now to protect those people, nothing in law to protect the child, the intended parents, or the surrogacy mother. We want to make sure that we study this issue fully so that we can put the best possible policy together. And The policies vary from state to state, country to country. Much like the Commission for Data Practices, we are able to call in experts in their fields and come up with solutions as legislators. So that's what this commission would do, is study this issue without having outside interests involved. I really truly believe this commission is the best solution for this issue at this time.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott, for tackling this issue. I know from listening to previous bills in the Senate that it's an area that I definitely agree with you. We need more discussion. We need more statutes around protection of families and the people that are involved in these contracts. It's really uncomfortable that we don't have any in this state. So I do really appreciate it. And I think a task force would be a good idea. In fact, or a working group. I have a bill up later on the agenda that does that with the working group, because I felt like it was really important to sit down with all the stakeholders that are involved to figure out what really needed to be done before we jump in feet first. So I completely agree with you on that. I'm still a little uncomfortable with the language. I feel like the working group maybe needs to be fleshed out more with some psychologists, people in the medical field, people that are familiar with it on a different level than we are as legislators. And then I'm also a little uncomfortable still with some of the duties listed under subsection 6 for various reasons, but one in particular on 2.21 to 2.22. I'm not familiar enough with our adoptive statutes if we require parents of adopted children to tell them they've been adopted. And this kind of feels like we'd require parents to tell their kids they were born of a surrogate. So I'm a little wondering why that was in there. And then I just had one question on compensation. With legislators on the panel, do they get per diem then? Because I know in other working groups and task forces when we have, I think the parental one that was put together that has the bill coming up later worked really, really hard on it, and I don't know if those legislators got per diem that were on it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, and Representative Joachim. When it's all legislators, I believe we're entitled to per diem, but I think it's considered our interim per diem, and so I think it would be maxed out at, I think it's 10 times or something like that. I don't know if Mr. Shepard knows the answer to that question.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, the current version of the draft does reference the per diem for legislators. As the bill moves along, might be good to think about the language, because the non-legislators that have been added here probably wouldn't be covered, or you wouldn't want them to be covered by that. And it is possible that, as Representative Scott suggested, you could leave this language out and then just leave it to the whatever system of interim per diem each house would like to provide to its members.
Thank you.
Representative Scott. Representative Joachim.
Thank you. Well, like I said before, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, thank you for working on this. I'm still kind of uncomfortable with the language, but I hope you'll take those comments into consideration as it moves forward.
Thank you, Representative Joachim. I wrote those down.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to thank you, Representative Scott, you know, for looking at this issue and for your openness and willingness, you know, to consider other suggestions. So that is great, and I do agree this is an issue that we need to legally address. I did just get a letter from the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, which was referenced earlier, and this is it's an organization of nearly 400 member practices performing more than 95% of the assisted reproductive technologically cycles in the United States, and it's this board of directors is doctors mainly, and you know, Mr. Atkins said earlier, talked about, you know, various organizations and people, you know, making money, you know, from this proposition, and it is true, but this organization, which, you know, what they do, says in the letter to me, the state of Minnesota has an opportunity to create a legal structure for regulating surrogacy agreements, which incorporates the rights and duties of all the parties involved in such agreements. So just to Mr. Atkins' point earlier, you know, it looks like folks involved would like a legal some legal parameters around this, and I don't want to belabor. Representative Joachim kind of covered the points that I was going to make, that, you know, I think that this is, you know you made a good start towards compromise, but I do think that the commission really would need to be fleshed out with more professionals involved, you know, different stakeholders involved in the actual surrogacy is not even the word that they want to use, but anyway, in the actual process involved with the birth of these children, and we don't have that here. We just mainly have legislators and a couple of other folks on that. So I'd like to see that too, and so in the end, then the purpose of your commission. Is it to develop a legal framework so that we have good outcomes all the time when this gestational, carrying takes place? What's the purpose I have a question. What is the purpose, the outcome of the commission supposed to be, so that it's all legal, safe, and no one is taken advantage of, or to ban surrogacy? Or what is the outcome of the commission?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seltzer, as with any other study group that we've had or commission, it's a fact-finding mission, so that we are informed as legislators to create policy on this matter. Surrogacy is not going away, and so we need to have good legal parameters that protect all parties. And so that would be my hope, is that we establish some good, the outcomes of this after the report goes out to the legislature, is that we come up with policies that will protect all parties involved.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. And, you know, and I'm too, I'm hopeful. I'm uncomfortable with parts of the bill as it states right now, and a lot of the my points were covered by Representative Joachim, but I hope that you'll keep working on this with all the parties involved.
Will do. Thank you.
Any final member discussion or questions? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott, and perhaps to Representative Joachim as well. I just wanted to probably give some information when we talk about information provided to a child. I think more what they're saying, and probably what happens with adoption too, is there some basic information that can be passed on, and that is for the child if the parents so choose to share it. And I'm really guessing that this is most likely what that is for too. It's just very basic information for the child. A lot of it has to do with family history and health history.
Any final member discussion? Seeing none, Representative Scott will give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you for the good questions, and thank you to all the testifiers. And I want everyone to know that this commission would be an open process, and that the many people and the interests that were represented here today will definitely be consulted as we move through a commission process. Thank you.
Representative Scott renews her motion that House File 437 be referred to State Government Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Next on the agenda, House File 1354, Representative Hackbarth. Representative Hackbarth, I'll go ahead and move your bill to be referred to Transportation.
Mr. Chairman and members. We're going to be very, very brief. We know you have an extensive agenda today, so what the bill does is puts volunteer firefighters in the same category as professional firefighters on this issue of providing health insurance should a firefighter die in the line of duty. Should a firefighter die in the line of duty, a professional firefighter right now, their family would receive health insurance through the city, and we want to extend that to volunteer firefighters, and that's pretty much the extent of the bill. And we have some testifiers, but I advise them to be very, very brief on their testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
George Espenson, with the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, legislative chair. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. We fully support this bill. This is an inequity that's existed for a long time, and we appreciate your consideration in writing this. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Rosenblum. I'm the president of the State Fire Department Association, representing the 20,000 firefighters and 18,000 volunteer paid-on-call firefighters in the state, and we fully support this motion.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Are there any member questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this seems like a no-brainer, but question I have is, I know that if this happens, there's going to be a cost to the municipality. How many a year, or how many instances are we talking about? I mean, one a year, one every 10 years, and I don't remember hearing of many, but you know, I guess how many we're talking about is probably very rare.
We'd like that. Go ahead.
I'll take care of that. Chairman and committee members, the answer to that is the average is about one every other year.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there, yeah, that's what I wanted to know, yeah.
Okay. But that's not always non-career firefighters. That's average across the board. Sorry about that.
Chairman, Representative Hackbar.
That includes the professional firefighters also that are already covered under the bill, or already covered before the bill.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson.
So then we're not talking a large, we're not talking about a huge mass of people that all of a sudden is going to put a strain on city budgets that going forward. It's fairly rare.
That's correct.
Representative Hackbar.
Thank you.
Any other member questions? Any other discussion to this House file? Seeing none, Representative Hackbarth will give you the last word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I know you have a tight schedule. Thank you very much for your time.
Our pleasure. Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Thank you to both the testifiers. Seeing no more discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 1354 be referred to the Transportation Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next on the agenda is House File 1974, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, I'll go ahead and move your bill and refer House File 1974 to State Government Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill before you today. House File 1547 just puts in statute the principles that we've been using for the last 20 years when it comes to redistricting. There's some slight modifications that I made to it, and I'm open to suggestions on it. I did modify the deviation from 1% to a 0.5%. That just makes sure that our districts are, as much as we can, equal in size. And then I also made sure that the responsibility of redistricting lies with the legislature, which is an elected body. So that's my bill in a nutshell, and I stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Ms. Strother, if you want to come on down. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State. We first want to thank Chair Anderson for bringing this bill. We do think that this is the time to be talking about redistricting in the state of Minnesota. We are mostly testifying, though, today to let the committee know that we are hoping to have an ongoing discussion about redistricting and possibly redistricting reform. We've been working with a multipartisan group of individuals looking at the Iowa model in particular that would be sort of a hybrid of keeping the legislature still as the ultimate decider on redistricting, but putting the initial map drawing in the hands of a group of retired judges. And so we are hoping to bring that to the legislature next year, and just wanted to make the committee aware of that.
Thank you, Ms. Strother.
Thank you.
Member questions. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Anderson. The only thing that really jumped out of me, and we talked about this before offline about this, about the bill, and it putting these in, I think that's, I don't, this is what we've used in the past. I don't see any real red flags with this. It's just with going from, I think the last redistricting, it says we were plus or minus 0.2%, and this is going to a 0.5%. I guess the concern I'd have there was, you know, what these are in priority of what you have to, if you're looking at it, to go down the list. It could make it difficult and divide cities and to get that. So, I mean, that's the only real concern I have, is that 0.5% might be more stringent that's possible with the size and shape of our state.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson. I'll take your suggestion under consideration. Thank you.
Representative Lane.
I guess maybe I wasn't paying attention. I'm a little confused. You not only have the 0.5% deviation rule, but you also prohibit the delegation of authority to any entity that is not comprised solely of members of the legislature. Is that correct?
Representative Anderson.
Say that again.
Representative Lane.
Prohibits delegation of the authority to any entity that is not comprised solely of members of the legislature.
Correct.
So it could never go to the court.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, it goes to the court when we are not able to come to an agreement, and as this language is written, it's saying that the responsibility lies with the legislature rather than another entity. But I'm open to suggestions that you may have.
Representative Lane.
So the way it happened in the last redistricting could not happen under this? Is that what I'm understanding?
Say that again.
The way it happened in this last redistricting time where the legislature could not agree and it went to the court system, that could not happen again? Or went to, not the court system, it went to some judges. That could not happen again?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lane, if you look at the language on lines 1.11 and 1.12, it says the legislature may not delegate its duty to anything else like a commission, council, plan, or other entity that is not comprised solely of the legislature. I don't view that as that it doesn't go to the court if we aren't able to come to an agreement. I view that as we wouldn't be able to say that a commission would be taking care of this responsibility rather than us drafting the original plans as the Constitution outlines. If we're not able to come to an agreement, it goes to the courts at that point.
Representative Lane.
I think I understand.
Any other member questions or discussion? Seeing none, would you like the last word?
No.
Sorry you're feeling under the weather. With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1974 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Next on the agenda, we're going to jump around and go to House File 1835, Representative Runbeck. Representative Runbeck, I have here that this can go to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, and thanks for hearing the bill today, 1835. I believe that with the Delete Everything Amendment, there is a small appropriation, and so I believe it would need to go to Environment Committee, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Okay.
So Representative Runbeck moves the DE2. And the motion on House File 1835 will be to refer 1835 to the Committee on Environment Finance.
Exactly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To your DE2, Representative Runbeck.
Yes. Members, House File 1835 deals with Metropolitan Water, subject we're all talking about in various venues. And The principal interest here is cities who are managing water all over our metro area, and the recent confusion of directives and statements and systems and mandates that are seeming to come through. And what we're trying to do here is consolidate and clarify water authority. The Met Council is still front and center in terms of the planning function, but we require a technical advisory committee to support them that is based with, made up of city engineers and people who really deal with water. And it requires a vote of a new policy commission. It's the reconstituted MOSAC, so they're still involved in the process too. And the key thing here is that the process will head back to the legislature for legislative oversight, legislative involvement in whatever these plans are that come through that affect all of our cities. So thanks for the help. Metro Cities has been very helpful. This has agreement with the Met Council, League of Minnesota Cities, and we do have bipartisan support as well. So that's really essentially what we're doing here, Mr. Chair.
Okay, members, why don't we go ahead and vote on the DE2 to make sure that it's in front of us and in the shape the author would like. Any discussion before we do that? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE2 is adopted. Representative Runbeck, do you want to move to your testifiers?
Mr. Chair, I do have Patty Nauman from the Metro Cities Organization.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the executive director of Metro Cities, which is an organization representing 90 cities in the metropolitan area, both before the legislature and Metro City Council. I've been before your committee before. I just want to thank Representative Runbeck for the work she's done on this bill with Metro Cities and the Met Council and with some of our specific member cities. Metro Cities does support having the Metropolitan Council play a planning role in water supply activities. We have been very close followers of the MOSAC over its tenure. And But we do believe that there is an important role for, as this work continues, to provide a chance to slow it down a little bit, step back, hold off on asking cities to be consistent with the regional master water supply plan until we have more agreement, more development of science by other stakeholders in order to move forward and then kind of figure out where we go. So again, we are not looking to take away the regional planning role that does have support, but we are looking to sort of broaden this out so that we have additional buy-in and input into the regional water supply planning work and what the impact of that work will be on local communities in the future. There is the appropriation in the bill. Metro City's policies do support funding for the work of the MOSAC that is prescribed in statute. We do support taking away the extension of the MOSAC because we recognize that this is very long-term planning work that will require both much activity, much input, and some level of funding. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Sir, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am Jason Willett. I'm Director of Finance and Energy for the Environmental Services Division of the Metropolitan Council. If you don't know MCES, we're primarily the wastewater utility for the 108 cities that are connected to our system. Lesser known is that we also have other water responsibilities, including the water supply planning authorities addressed in sections 1, 2, and 4 of this bill. I do come before you to say we're supporting this compromise, and I appreciate the work that Representative Runbeck and Ms. Nauman have done to get to something that's acceptable for us. The changes that are on the front page here that delete the mandatory consistency between the local and water supply master plan is a substantial concession, particularly for our planners to lose that language. But we do agree that we need to work harder for broad consensus and collaboration, and we're willing to do that for this. We do also appreciate that we have hopefully an appropriation or a fee structure that will help us provide the technical resources to shine the light on the situation in the future. What this does, Mr. Chair, is gives us the ability to shine a light. If there were a turkey in the woods, we could do that. We can't shoot them, though. You'll still have to deal with that. With that, I would just like to say thank you again for all the cooperation.
Thank you, Mr. Willett. And I see Representative Fisher in the back. I know you've been working hard on this as well. Do you have anything to say to the committee at this time?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just appreciate the opportunity. It's been an honor working with Representative Runbeck and all the parties involved to help address this. This is a critical issue to help bring everybody together to help move what will be hopefully a sustainable solution for addressing the water issues in our area.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Any member questions or discussion? Seeing none, Representative Runbeck, we will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope we kept it to 5 minutes, and do appreciate the committee's indulgence. I'm really, you know, it's great to see how consensus happens. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Hold on one more. I just want to make sure that we are sending this to the right place, which is, I think, the discussion happening on the sidebar. Oh. Members, we're going to temporarily lay the bill over while we figure out where we're setting this, and we'll come right back to it. The bill is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton. Representative Norton, you have two bills in front of the committee. Which one would you like to take up first?
Mr. Chair, could we take up House File 1056, please?
We sure can. Representative Nelson, would you like to make the motion?
Where does this need to go, Rep. Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson, we have HHS reform.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that 1056 be referred to HHS reform.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Norton, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think we'll go into a huge amount of detail about the bill, but I do want some explanation, and so we brought some law enforcement from my community today, and I think there are a couple other advocates that are here that could answer questions if you have them when we're done. But this particular bill creates a grant program to be administered by the Department of Public Safety, which would assist local law enforcement agencies to have a successful fine for persons who tend to wander off. This bill has in our community been used, I think, for a variety of different persons, but in particular the advocates for the children with autism have been very concerned about this particular issue and have long time advocated for it, as well as our growing population of Alzheimer's disease clients, unfortunately a growing population of folks with dementia and Alzheimer's. But it's for anyone who is vulnerable. It does not replace care, one-on-one vision and supervision of vulnerable folks, but it is a methodology that will help find them using radio frequencies. And I think what I'd like to do is move, have an amendment that you should have moved first before we go further, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Nelson moves the A15-0256 amendment, and this is an author's amendment, correct?
It is.
Okay. All in favor of this long-numbered amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Representative Norton, to your bill is amended.
Thank you. And I did just want to say it is a grant program. It is voluntary. Any law enforcement agency that cares to participate can participate in it. What we did is we changed it as a first-come, first-served, because one of the things in the long-term care committee that they talked about was, and we talked at length about, is that any amount of money could be put into the grant program. Some words up of $300,000 probably would cover everyone in the state, law enforcement-wise, that would want to participate in it, but we know they all won't. It's voluntary. Some like it, some won't. But we want it to be scalable based on the budgets that you have moving ahead, and this will allow that to happen. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have some testifiers.
Welcome to the committee, gentlemen. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record.
Sergeant Ryan Manguson with the Rochester Police Department. 17 years in law enforcement, and I've been involved with Project Lifesaver locally in Rochester, Homestead County, for the past 8 years. In law enforcement, we have many tools on our tool belt, which keep us from fitting in chairs easily, but this is another tool to the tool belt. And with the growing increase in diagnosis of autism and Alzheimer's, it's an increasingly important tool to have. So I'm here in support of the legislation, the Lifesaver legislation. We did bring the equipment with us today to help demonstrate to you how it works. I see it extremely important. It allows us to bring vulnerable people back to their caregivers and loved ones much more rapidly than without the equipment. So it is extremely valuable to that point. Currently in Olmsted County, Rochester Olmsted County, we have 21 active members in our program, active search team members, which are officers and deputies from the Rochester Police Department and the Olmsted County Sheriff's Office. We also have currently 64 clients with the transmitters in our community. We've had up to 70 at a time, depending on the severity of their status, it kind of ebbs and flows, so that can increase and decrease. Sergeant Kirby Long here with the Olmsted County Sheriff's Office is my partner in the program, co-supervises the Sheriff's Office side, and he'll also provide you some additional information to our program. But bottom line of our support here today is to be in support of this legislation to help take this program statewide, to provide this tool to law enforcement and other public safety agencies throughout the state to help bring loved ones home faster. So that's why we're here in support.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. Again, I'm Sergeant Kirby Long with the Olmsted County Sheriff's Office. And just a little bit about the equipment that is involved with this. This little transmitter here is a radio frequency transmitter, which has a set frequency, and then we have our receiver that we program in the frequency of the transmitter, and when a person on the program goes missing, the caregiver contacts our dispatch center 911, and our team is activated, is paged out to go on a search. And by using this technology, the range from in our vehicles, we can pick up the signal approximately a mile away, and if we search from the air, it's 5 to 7 miles distance that we can receive the signal. The costs typically are right around $390 for the first year and reduces to about $45 per year after that. And the receiver is approximately $1,500. So not a huge amount to get somebody going on this, but it can certainly save a lot of time and money for when somebody that wanders does go missing. Back in 2011 in Olmsted County, we had a 68-year-old gentleman who had some cognitive disorder, went missing. We spent 3 days searching for the gentleman, and at a cost of over $10,000 spent to search for him. We did locate him alive, and after he got out of the hospital, he went on the program. And we went out 2 weeks later. We had a training. We went out and set the transmitter where he was located and gave the team the same scenario that our officers received when they're dispatched to the call when he initially went missing. It took approximately 20 minutes to receive the signal, and it took approximately 25 to 30 minutes for our team to get to that location because it was such rugged terrain. And with that, if he had been wearing this type of technology, we could have found that gentleman within an hour and not have had to spend 3 days searching for him and have him laying out in the elements for 3 days, which is very important. And he could have easily perished in that situation. And I know there's a number of situations in which children and folks have perished when they've gone missing. Since 2009, we have had 13 call-outs. 9 of those, the person that wandered was located prior to our equipment arriving on scene. And for the other cases, our officer did arrive on scene with our equipment and locate the individual. And all those finds were under 30 minutes.
I would just add that you know, these instances of having of vulnerable people who go wandering, I would consider it a low frequency, high risk situation. Meaning, it may be a low frequency that it occurs, but when it does occur, there's a lot of risk. There's high risk. So having a tool available to us to bring these people back home safely as fast as possible is extremely important.
Thank you both for your testimony. Member question and discussion. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton. I'm going to thank you again for bringing this forward. It's an absolutely fantastic idea, which not only hits our elderly, but also folks with autism. And one of the things you did talk about today, which was really impressive to me, is how far underwater this can be seen, because somebody with autism, water is a death trap. And so to me, that was it's heartbreaking, but it's comforting to know that it does work in those ways. And I've got a twofer here, so I'm already going to testify to what Representative Joaquim is going to do and say, together, this is a great idea for Minnesota. So you absolutely have my support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And probably to one of the officers. I'm the data practices person. You probably already know that. But are we tracking these people, or is this just that sends an alarm off if they go missing?
The radio frequency technology that they wear constantly is emitting a signal. Every 1 second, it's emitting a signal. But we're not tracking them unless our caregiver calls in and reports that they're missing and they need help.
All right. Found. That's all.
Thank you, Officer Magnuson. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton. This is the first time I've heard this bill, and I echo the accolades to you and to the officers for explaining this. I'm just really looking forward to having this serve so many families and communities throughout the state of Minnesota. I happen to know someone, a constituent, who is 90 years old, and he's caring for his 87-year-old wife with dementia in their home. And I believe that he purchased one of these base units and that his wife is wearing some sort of a bracelet or carrying a device like this. So my question is, just wondering, a couple of questions about this base unit. I'm assuming there's this base unit. Is that what you are holding up? And then there's the little devices, the bracelet that the person with, say, dementia would be wearing. But I'm wondering how many of those would be served by your one base unit? I'm not the most tech-savvy girl here.
Officer Magnuson.
There are different technologies out there, different companies providing different types of technologies. The way our program works is it's radio frequency technology. The client wears a transmitter that our officers come and we do the maintenance. We meet with the client once a month and change the battery, make sure it's fresh, and we check and make sure things are working. The caregivers themselves have a tester, which they hold over the transmitter, which just emits a light, flashes, which lets them know that it's working properly. If it doesn't work properly, if they don't get the light, they contact law enforcement and we change it. The base unit we're talking about must be a different program or different type of technology. But what happens is, this is radio frequency. It's different than, you know, a lot of people think, well, why wouldn't we use GPS? Well, GPS, if you have like a satellite radio in your car, when you know you pull in the garage, you lose the satellite connection. Well, GPS works that same way. If you're in heavy foliage, or you're in a cave, or you're in a building, you don't get a GPS location. It's just the technology's not quite there yet. Where radio frequency is kind of the most standard frequency that works. With that said, the question was about tracking. We can only track this when we're within the mile of where it's being emitted with the radio frequency tracker. The best way to kind of to put this into perspective for you, if you remember seeing the technology, it's the same type of technology if you'd seen in like old National Geographic shows where they're tracking bears, and the bears wear a large collar around their neck and they're using a big antenna to track the location of the bear. It's actually the same type of technology that has been transferred over to be able to track people. The technology has been cut down to size so that it's wearable, and it's the same type of technology.
I believe you also had a question as to like how many people can we track or whatever. Each individual transmitter has its own unique frequency, and this receiver, we just program in that specialized frequency number for that client, and so we could have 1,000, 2,000 people on our program.
Thank you. Quick follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pugh.
Yes, and so this is, are you a pilot program in Olmsted County, or are there other communities throughout the state of Minnesota that are already utilizing this technology?
Representative Saunders.
Representative Norton.
And Representative Pugh. I neglected to go into that at the beginning because we're trying to keep this short, and I hate to drag it on. I'm sorry. But there are about 30% of Minnesota's 87 counties, so about 26 of them have used Project Lifesaver. And as was mentioned, there are a number of vendors and people that the county could choose whichever vendor they wanted. We're not promoting a particular vendor. Within those counties, another 22 agencies also have chosen to do it. So you might have a county that would do it, a sheriff's department, but you also might have the city police, as we do, that partner together in the trainings. So it's about 48 combined agencies in the state of Minnesota, and we want to be able to offer this to others. And so this just basically pays for the receiver, and it pays for the training that the officers need initially and ongoing. I think there's quarterly trainings that they go through. And that's what the grant will pay for. It's about, we're thinking about $8,000 or $6,000 for a training for a grant recipient. So a little bit of money can go a long way, which is why we really like the idea that it's scalable. Because if we don't have a lot of money to spend this year, we can start allowing it to move out with a smaller amount and continue it in the years ahead. First come, first serve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton, and the testifiers.
Any final member questions? Any final member discussion? Seeing none, we'll give you the last word, Representative Norton.
Well, I have other advocates here that would be happy to speak, but I hope we don't need it. I hope you can see that this is really would be to the advantage of law enforcement and certainly to our vulnerable citizens, so I'd really appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Norton, and thank you both gentlemen for your testimony and for your service. With that, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1056 be referred to HHS reform.
As amended.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
And quickly, before we get to the next Norton bill, we're going to bring up House File 1835 again. I'm going to withdraw my previous motion and make a motion that House File 1835 be sent to State Government Finance as amended. Any discussion to that before we take a vote? Okay, I will renew my motion that House File 1835 be sent to State Government Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Norton, onto House File 512.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have a DE amendment as well.
Let's see here.
Mr. Chair, where does it have to go?
We're going to send 512 to HHS Finance, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that House File 512 be sent to HHS Finance.
Representative Nelson moves 512 to HHS Finance.
Mr. Chair, I would move the DE1 amendment.
Representative Scott moves the DE1. Any discussion of the DE1 before we put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment prevails. Representative Norton, to your bill is amended.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Some of you may know there's been a large effort to do some reform in the area of child support and divorce and custody that many members have been working on, and there's a package of bills moving through the legislature to address that. House File 512, I'm sorry, was one of those. Unfortunately, after its first hearing, we've been working out the numbers, and we have a level of discomfort that the formula that we have before you is exactly right. And rather than rush something through and be disruptive to folks, we've decided to take a step back, which is why you have the DE1. We've worked with the department, and they have helped us kind of come to the understanding that perhaps what we need to do is have a work group that will bring back the recommended, after they've worked with an economist, bring back a better formula or check to make sure our formula might be right. We don't know that, but we don't want to move ahead until we're really clear that we have this child support formula correct. So it's a working group to do that, and also to set up a permanent commission, because the department was pretty clear that we do not look often enough and critically enough at our child support laws in the state to update things due to cost of living or reports that come out nationally or federally or statewide, and we want that to happen. So this bill does both of those, and I have actually the expert here that helped do a lot of this to fill in details for you.
Thank you, Representative Norton. And to the testifier, if you would please announce yourself and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. Actually, Representative Norton did a pretty good job of actually describing the DE, so I'm happy to answer questions if there are any. But again, this is really to make sure that when we're talking about child support and the intersection of parenting time, that we're doing it in a way, I think we all have agreement on making sure we're reducing some litigation that we're seeing now under current law that we can make better. And so it's really just getting the formula right to get it there.
Thank you, Ms. Hagdell. And Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say that Representative Scott and I and Representative Norton and Representative Tim Mahoney have been on this child custody dialogue group for 2.5 years, working to a level of trust and working from that to see what we could produce to make the whole system work better for everyone. And we have come forth with some legislation, and this was one of the pieces that would solve a major problem in fighting among parents with disagreements, and but it's not quite ready for prime time. So we're taking a step back, as she said, to do a study group on and make it work for Minnesota. I highly support this, of course, and the other bills that we're carrying this year.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Any other members who would be interested in commenting, questioning? No. Representative Norton, final comments.
Just thank you very much for your support of this. It's as was mentioned, it's been several years of hard work, and we're getting very close. This will help us get all the way, I hope.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Norton. So Representative Nelson renews his motion for House File 512 as amended to move to HHS Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? So the motion passes.
Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair,
Madam
Representative.
Chair. Thank you. Just while the next team is coming up, I'd like to invite folks in the audience to come and share with us in our abundant cookies and sweets. So please help yourself before you leave or anytime. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Joaquim, House File 805. I'd like to thank you for your fabulous treats that you brought to the committee, and we look yes. forward to your presenting your bill. So proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I brought donuts because, of course, I am a freshman, and I haven't been before our committee yet. So I was reading the traditional rule as every new committee you go to, you have to bring treats. So that's why they're there. They're from a hometown bakery. Hope you liked them.
Well done, Representative Joaquim.
All right. So, House File 805 has truly been a labor of love for me. I know how full the agenda is, so I'll try to speed this up. As many of you members know, people bring bills in front of our committees all the time that they've worked on because they've had personal experience with them, and that's what this is for me. My grandmother had Alzheimer's for the few years before she died, and her husband also had dementia before he died as well. At the time when she was home alone after her husband died, she was still living in her home, and my mother and her siblings were sharing the task of taking care of her, and they also had someone come in during the days. But there was always that worry about that gap time or that time when she was asleep, if someone couldn't be there that night, that she might wander off. And she lived about a block off of Lake Palin, so water was a concern too. I wish we would have known about Representative Norton's pilot project, because I think that would have come in handy. So when I, well, let's see here. This is what happens when I try to speed up. I lose my place. Through my experience with my grandmother and grandfather who had dementia at the end of his life, I became familiar with a silver alert from a colleague. And it's something that other states do have, about a little over 20 states, and there's different criteria in each of the states. So I wanted to start working on something like that in Minnesota. I reached out to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension because Janelle Rasmussen, who's the Director of Criminal Justice Training and Education with the BCA, has been part of working groups across the nation setting criteria for our Amber Alert. And this would be something like an Amber Alert, but geared towards those who have Alzheimer's, dementia, or traumatic brain injury. And I didn't want to just tell the BCA that they had to do it. I firmly do believe in working groups of stakeholders coming together and figuring out the best way to approach it. We do have some systems in place in Minnesota, as you know. We have Brandon's Law. We have the Amber Alert for younger children. And we also have an emergency action network. So I wanted to bring this group of stakeholders together, and you'll see them listed in the bill under membership, to really sit down and look and see where our holes are and what we need to do and if a silver alert would fit here. I do have Janelle Rasmussen here from the BCA. I also have the Alzheimer's Association here, and you should have a letter of support in your packet and some handouts about Alzheimer's and wandering. But I have Heidi Haley Franklin, the Vice President of Clinical Services here at the Alzheimer's Association, to give brief testimony if you would like. And Ms. Rasmussen here to answer any technical questions about the program. So whichever you would prefer to go first.
That's up to you, Representative Joaquim. We'll let you do that. But
Heidi Haley Franklin, come down here with the Alzheimer's Association. I want to thank them for being so patient and being here all morning. and waiting. There's about four of them here from the organization today. So,
While she's getting settled in, do you want to go ahead and move your bill to
yes.
HHS Finance, please?
HHS Finance?
That's
or,
what I have here.
It actually is under the BCA working group, so it should go to public safety. There's no fiscal note with HHS at all.
That's fine. Go ahead.
Okay, so I had talked to Representative Cornish about it, too. So I would like to move it to public safety and crime prevention.
Okay. Ma'am, welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Heidi Haley Franklin. I'm the Vice President for Clinical Services with the Alzheimer's Association. The Alzheimer's Association is the world's leading health organization in Alzheimer's care support and research, and we would like to express our strong support for House File 805 to create a working group to thoughtfully determine the need for a silver alert system in the state of Minnesota. Currently, there's an estimated 100,000 Minnesotans living with Alzheimer's disease and an additional 245,000 family caregivers in our state who are providing care and support. With age being the greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's, this number is set to skyrocket. Alzheimer's is a public health crisis and the defining disease for the baby boom generation. The reality is that 6 out of 10 individuals with Alzheimer's or dementia will wander at some point in the disease process, and many will wander repeatedly. Caregivers expect symptoms of severe memory loss and confusion, but they're not typically prepared to be on a state of alert to monitor the whereabouts of their family member with dementia. These family caregivers never know when wandering will take place. However, they do know that it can be dangerous and often life-threatening. If individuals with dementia are not found within 24 hours, up to 50% will suffer severe injury or death. In addition, a person with memory loss may not be able to provide their name or address to the person who finds them and may not even appear to know that he is lost. Even if they're located, reuniting them with a family member presents challenges. You may know that wandering is a common symptom of dementia, and it poses constant stress, which weighs heavily on caregivers and all family members. These wandering incidents must be treated as an emergency, and the response must begin immediately. Wandering is not limited to community settings. It can occur in assisted living, nursing homes, and memory care facilities, creating an even greater urgency for immediate action to take place. I urge the committee to move forward this very important piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
And is there any questions from the members for Ms. Heidi Frank? Heidi Haley Franklin.
Any member questions to the testifier?
Then I'd
seeing
like to,
none.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to have Janelle Rasmussen from the BCA come forward. She's
behind you. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. My name is Janelle Rasmussen. I am the statewide Amber Alert Coordinator at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And Representative Joachim reached out to us to talk about the systems that we currently have in place in Minnesota, as she mentioned. And with the Amber Alert Plan, we also utilize the Minnesota Crime Alert Network to transmit alerts about missing people, children who may not meet the Amber Alert criteria, but also elderly or other cases where someone might be endangered, to ask for the public's help in getting that information out. And then we utilize a number of other systems. This bill gives us the opportunity to look at what we're currently doing, what other states are doing, and to examine our criteria and see if there's a program that we could also implement here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Rasmussen. Any member questions to this testifier? Seeing none, do you have any other testifiers?
Or just Mr. Chair.
Technical
Mr.
support.
Chair. No, I do not.
Okay. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to make the comment that my father-in-law actually died of Alzheimer's over a period of time. But he, when he was in his early serious phase of it, would just leave. And it wasn't that he would disappear when you weren't watching. He would just insist that he's going. And my mother-in-law was not able to stop him or go after him. So it's up in Chisholm, a small town, but she could then call the police and they would go and find him. So the finding wasn't quite as bad as talking him back So this working group may have to do more than just locate the person, but also how are you going to get them in the car to go back home again? It's a whole process.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Seltzer, did you have a question?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was answered, but I just want to thank Representative Joachim for bringing forward this very important bill.
Thank you, Representative Seltzer. Any final member questions or discussion? Seeing none, Representative Joachim, you have the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I know I shared my personal story in the beginning, but I know it's not unique. I know there's many members here that probably have this in their family as well. And I just want to say thank you for hearing me out today, and I would like to renew my motion to send House File 805 to Public Safety and Crime Prevention.
Representative Joachim renews her motion. The House File 805 be sent to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, is
Representative Nelson.
Is our last authors coming up here. When we're done, before we adjourn, can we get an outlook on what for next week and what you expect? Are we going to have long meetings again, late night meetings again? Would you do that after the before we adjourn, please?
Yes, Representative Nelson. We'll spend this time thinking about the many ways we can punish everyone next week. Representative Mullery, you have the extreme enviable position of that Representative Albright found himself in last night, being the last bill on the agenda.
Before, how can anybody be rushing to dinner after the
That's right.
we've had this morning? And, Mr. Chair, this is a strange request from a bill presenter, but would you, since I was talking to my witness at the time of the minutes, I was wondering if you'd love to put on page 4, just before the end of Representative Quam's bill, that insert Mullery requested that he be listed as wanting to vote against this bill. It would be a great help at my next endorsing convention.
So noted. It's on the record now, Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair and members, first I'll move House File 827 and then the DE1 amendment.
Okay. Representative Mullery moves House File 827. I have it that needs to go to civil law. Is that correct?
Not that I know of. I never heard that from anybody.
Representative Scott, are you?
I'm just looking here.
Did you have a destination in mind, Representative Mullery?
I was told that it just had to go to HHS policy and then here and then to the floor.
Okay. So. Well, we can send it to the General Register, then, Representative Mullery, and if Representative Scott during the discussion needs it, we can have that discussion. But Representative Mullery moves House File 827 to the General Register, and then Representative Mullery moves his DE1. Members, any discussion before we put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Mullery, to your bill as
Thank
amended.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, we can all remember the horror stories that unfortunately were true about what was happening to kids in Minnesota, especially little kids. One out in western Minnesota was probably the worst, but there was a lot of articles in the paper, and the governor appointed a task force to look into the problems with child abuse in Minnesota and the child protection system. And with me here this morning as a witness is Rich Gurman, who was the kind of the voice in the wilderness for a long time and trying to alert everyone about the huge problems that were going on. And it was kind of, when we tried to look into it, that we were getting information that everything was fine pretty much. And he kept on it, and then there was the newspaper reports that brought it to the fore. And that's why the governor created the task force. And in my 19 years here, I've never seen a task force that worked anywhere near as hard as this. But there's still a lot of things undone. And they're having a final report, which clearly will not be able to go through the whole system this year and become law. and recommendations, but they're going to come up with a lot, and even then there is going to be a lot that we need to do to get this system back turned around. And so at one point I had thought that the governor would continue the task force, but that turned out to be not the case, and they don't want to pursue that, but they are fine with the legislative group with us setting up a task force. And the senators are Rosen and Sharon, and then Representative Cresha and I. And Senator Rosen is carrying this bill in the Senate, and I've worked a lot with Representative Cresha, and in fact quite a few of the new ideas in here are his. And so in the end we worked out the exact language with the department, and it's we're all in agreement, the legislators and the department, that we need to have, and that the public demands that we continue this task force and keep this out in the open, and having the department come in and say how they're trying to implement the initial recommendations of the governor's task force, and yet also bring up new things that that was so narrowly crafted that a lot of issues that related very closely to child abuse and child protection couldn't be looked at, and the department and the legislators involved and the rest of the members of the task force also want these looked into. So what this would do would be just continue that. And I thought Mr. Gurman, since he's been the leader on the issue, from the public also would like to say something to you this morning.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Rich Gurman. I'm the executive director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota, and we are an advocacy organization in the child welfare arena. I'm here today just to offer support for Representative Mullery's bill. Over the past 5 or 6 years, many of you have seen our volunteers here advocating not just for more funding for child protection, but also for more oversight and engagement by the legislature. We think that's necessary, really, to move the agenda forward. The task force, as the representative mentioned, will come out with its final recommendations on Monday. There'll be many good recommendations. I really personally want to commend the leadership of the Department of Human Services. It has been really, we've moved forward largely because of the leadership they've shown over the last 6 months. But in terms of checks and balances, we think that the legislature historically has not played a very strong role. In terms of this program, and we think that Representative Mullery's bill is a way for the legislature to continue to be involved for the next year, and hopefully that will be a building block for some ongoing structure where the legislature continues to be engaged and provide oversight and encouragement to the program.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any member questions or discussions? Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, and to the testifier, thanks for doing this. I applaud your efforts, and from a personal perspective, I came from a very abusive household and was abused myself for the better part of my childhood, and I appreciate you doing this. It's important to have the legislative oversight to protect kids. Not everybody gets to find a way out like I did, but it's important, and this is why we're here.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
We'll look to some help from you then as we proceed. Thanks very much.
Any other member questions or discussion? Seeing none, we have spoke with the Chair of Civil Law, spoke with Representative Mullery as well. The committee does believe that the General Register is the appropriate place for this bill at this time. Any final member questions or discussion? Seeing none, Representative Mullery will give you the last word.
Let's break for more eating.
With that, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 827 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Members, big, big thank you to everyone. What a tremendous amount of volume we got through this week. I want to thank you all. Special thanks to the DFL researcher, Mr. Geldman, for the work he did for your caucus in the committee, as well as Republican House researcher, Abby Loesch. And a special thank you to our nonpartisan House researchers and counsel that got us through this entire week, Mr. Shepard, Ms. Dyson, Mr. Gehring, tremendous amount of work. Thank you as well to our pages for all the work that they did and for the long hours. And thanks for everyone for the participation. I think we had some really, really good discussions, but overall, just a tremendous amount of committee work done this week. As of now, we have approximately 15 bills that we are aware of that we need to hear next week. With that, that sounds like we are probably only in for morning hearings next week, which would be really good. We have sent out emails to all CAs asking for any and all bills that could possibly come our direction, so we'll have a better understanding at the end of the day. But we anticipate at this point only having morning hearings next week. Of course, that's subject to change, but that's our hope, and we will do our best to keep it that way for next week. Any final member discussion before we adjourn for the first deadline? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your indulgence, too, in hearing many, many bills. And I also wanted to thank both Amanda and Nolan as well.
Absolutely. The CA for this committee, Amanda Tinsley, and the CLA, Nolan West, we would not have been able to have done it all without them. So thank you all. Members, thank you for your work. Hope everyone can have a great weekend. We are adjourned.